This is The Infinite City, stories from Belfast of people and place. I'm Rebecca McCabe.
And I'm Connor McCafferty. The built environment we see around us in Belfast, like any city, could be very different. Some buildings and streets, even entire neighbourhoods, stand for years before making way for something new.
And some designs were destined always to remain unbuilt. They never made it off the drawing board in the first place. In today's episode, we consider one of Belfast's major city centre developments of the 20th century, and we ask, how does big development like this happen in a city?
And what else, demolished or unbuilt, might have stood in its place?
The history of Belfast is the history of big developments.
If you walk out of our office on Lower Garfield Street and go a few yards to the right, you arrive at a junction about halfway up Royal Avenue, one of Belfast's central thoroughfares and a key route through the city centre.
So if we were to walk one way, we would end up at the City Hall, of course, a key civic space. If we were to walk the other way, it would take us towards the Central Library and parts of North Belfast.
We're with Andrew McClelland, a conservation architect. Facing us from across the street is a long facade of glass and steel, 5 stories high. A narrow awning extends over the pavement, held up by slender struts. These struts climb the front of the building, terminating at small cylindrical posts that punctuate the roofline at regular intervals.
From the ground floor windows, mannequins peer onto the street alongside adverts and shop displays. The square windows of the floors above are all opaque, either mirrored or smoked glass. We can't see what lies beyond. Instead, the old Victorian buildings across the street appear in a wobbly reflection. On a warm day, some of these windows lie open, letting in fresh air for the people working in offices behind.
We're just standing right outside the Castle Court shopping centre, which is essentially a glass-fronted, covered mall constructed in the 1980s.
This is Castle Court, viewed from Royal Avenue. A slice of techno-futurism. Right-angled blocks of glazing are broken up by curved elements. There are rounded stairwell coverings, those slender tubes that line the facade, and a grand double swoop that beckons pedestrians off the street through the sliding doors and into the covered shopping mall within.
Castle Court borrows from the precedence of Royal Avenue and follows the same street line as buildings adjacent and opposite.
On the other side, we still have some surviving remnants from Victorian era development in the 1880s. So some Italianate style buildings and then some more modern buildings of the same scale, but of course very different architecturally. So you get a mixture of sort of 1980s development and as well as then some surviving buildings from the 1880s.
Castle Court also shares a similar height with neighbouring buildings, somewhere between 4 and 5 stories.
But Castle Court is massive. It's a complete break with what urbanists refer to as the grain of the area. Royal Avenue is made up of plots filled with a single building. These plots are what make up the city blocks, which are permeated at intervals by smaller streets. Castle Court, on the other hand, takes up several blocks in an unbroken facade with only a handful of entrances.
To accommodate such a large-scale structure right in the centre of the city, the streetscape that had existed before on the site had to be entirely swept away. The construction of Castle Court didn't just transform Royal Avenue beyond recognition. It also swallowed up much of the historic market area that lay behind it. Castle Court erased entire streets that had once formed routes through this part of the city, many of which were older even than Royal Avenue itself.
Okay, which way do you want to go?
that's actually part of the problem, I guess, of the Castle Court development, because obviously we have to walk around as opposed to walk through. And in a sense, a key aspect of that development was not just, of course, the loss of certain individual buildings that people would have considered to be of historic importance, but equally that kind of sense of permeability and the capacity to walk through the site, as opposed to now with, obviously, the covered shopping mall.
Between when Royal Avenue was originally laid out in the 1880s and the construction of Castle Court 100 years later, society in Belfast was utterly transformed. There was the political upheaval and civil conflict for which the city became notorious, as well as more universal shifts. Around the world, new trends in architecture and town planning dramatically altered the form and appearance of cities as architects and developers took their cues from modern global fashions. By the 1970s, a lot of Victorian architecture was run down and out of favour.
New styles of buildings had begun to appear on the streets of Belfast, along with new attitudes to city living. Modern planning had reconfigured not just the city centre, but also the region well beyond the city limits. In Belfast especially, the 70s witnessed a general disaffection with city life. Consumer expectations were being shaped by new suburban lifestyles, more affordable private cars, and a desire to avoid the risks associated with the city centre.
Castle Court would meet these expectations by demolishing older buildings and covering over the existing street pattern to create an all-in-one experience. Construction would not begin on this site until the middle of the 1980s. But in the background, for many years, largely hidden from public view, plans were taking shape that would eventually coalesce into the Castle Court development. Did such an unlikely, outsized scheme get off the drawing board? To understand how the final design came about and its continuing influence on Belfast, it helps to picture what this part of the city had been like before. Imagine you're back again at the top of Lower Garfield Street and you look across at Royal Avenue, down towards Berry Street to the far edge of what's now Castle Court. What you would see is a block of distinct individual buildings of various styles and forms.
In sort of the early to mid-1980s, we would still have the Grand Central Hotel, a kind of a four or five storey Italianate type structure with a turret on one corner. Just up from the Grand Central Hotel would have been the General Post Office, which was described as a kind of Victorian Romanesque building. So quite an imposing building, but quite grimy in appearance through the accumulated pollution and how that reacted with the stonework of that building over the course of the century that it survived.
The General Post Office fronted onto Royal Avenue at the corner of a street which no longer exists, called Garfield Street.
It was still operating as a post office until around about, I think, 1984, 1985. That particular building, of course, was fronting Royal Avenue, but it was interconnected by a platform at the first floor to quite significant extensions then to the rear running towards Smithfield Square. Then past the General Post Office, we would have had essentially a continuation of Garfield Street. So of course now we only have Lower Garfield Street, but then there would have been Garfield Street running all the way down. There would have been the Avenue Cinema, then on the other side, sort of creating those two corners between the General Post Office and the continuation of Royal Avenue development.
At the time it was first laid out, Royal Avenue itself was one of the most ambitious developments Belfast had seen. It signalled the city's emergence into the modern era. It was an act of stage setting. A city of imperial and industrial importance ought to have a grand avenue to impress its visitors and residents. Two much smaller residential streets, John Street and Hercules Street, were swept away along with the small-scale courtyards and entries that ran off them, with one notable exception, which we'll get to later.
Striking new buildings of four and five stories lined either side of a bold new avenue that emphasised a strong north-south axis. Royal Avenue confidently announced the city's wealth and power, and its shops and department stores attracted a burgeoning consumer class. By the turn of the 20th century, Royal Avenue would lead into Donegal Place and onwards in an unbroken streetscape to the new urban centrepiece, City Hall.
So it was pretty coherent, sort of 1880s Victorian development, where all of the buildings were individually different in terms of their architectural styling and their function, of course. And they, of course, then continued right the way through towards York Street, sort of dog-legging round the other part of Royal Avenue development. So it was sort of coherent because of the heights and the cornice line, but individually different, kind of stylized buildings still surviving in the early 1980s.
That historic streetscape had survived the threat of destruction from several directions. Violent and dramatic change reshaped Belfast in numerous ways. The centre of the city was caught between the threat of bombing and the unintended consequences of the security response.
So where we're now standing was, of course, within what was known as the Ring of Steel. Because of various bombing incidences because of fire damage caused through incendiary devices, etc., etc. So as part of the security apparatus that the British government implemented in the centre of Belfast, cars, pedestrians, etc. were controlled accessing this point. Just down from where we're standing right now would have been the Grand Central Hotel, which throughout most of the 1970s would have been an actual base for a British Army regiment within the Ring of Steel. Of course, the decade previously, that was a functioning hotel building. But in the late 1970s, 1980s, this was quite a derelict part of the city. I suppose in contrast to what it might have been 15, 20 years prior to that particular point.
Despite making the city centre more secure, the Ring of Steel ultimately had a deadening effect, and the northern end of the city in particular quickly succumbed to dereliction. Smithfield Market lay just outside the Ring of Steel, marking the threshold of the city centre, especially for people coming in from the west and north of the city.
For more than 100 years, the stalls and shopfronts of Smithfield Market had served an important secondary function to the opulence and aspiration of Royal Avenue. It was filled with an array of antiques, books and bric-a-brac and endured through the 20th century as a cherished place to mix and mingle. Until it was firebombed in 1974.
Well, it was four streets around the covered market. The market itself historically wouldn't have been covered, but then it was at the time of the development of Royal Avenue. You know, it was a significant loss. It was a significant loss. It was described, I think, by one author as kind of part of the soul of Belfast, essentially was lost with the firebombing of that building. It was like eclectic. There was all sorts of old antique places, secondhand bookstores. It was a place where people would have come from all strata, social strata of Belfast, and socialised.
The loss of the old Smithfield Market was pivotal because it added justification for the vast new construction that was to come.
The fact that that was lost, that essentially created what was later termed by some of the politicians involved in backing the Castlecourt scheme as the big hole that has to be filled. And that was partly because of the destruction of Smithfield Market.
The firebombing brought a new impetus to plans for the area, but it wasn't the first time anyone had thought about redeveloping the site, for one very important reason. As it turned out, much of the site was in public ownership. The General Post Office, along with extensive service buildings to its rear, was publicly owned.
Going back as far as the 1840s, Belfast Corporation had brought all the markets in the city into public ownership, including Smithfield Market. The bus station at Millfield too was publicly owned. Plans to relocate the post office and the bus station removed the final impediments. For Andrew, the ownership pattern has proven crucial to the story of Castlecourt.
What's interesting, and I think it's interesting for all developments, there was always kind of trace elements in previous planning proposals, partly because of this ownership context. For example, part of what became the Castlecourt site, even in the 1940s, in one of the very first planning schemes for Belfast in the context of the war, would have been sort of a central bus station. In the Belfast Urban Area Plan, 1969, this area was earmarked for a kind of a comprehensive redevelopment, and including a central bus station, including a establishment of a regional college, including a hotel and various other things. And that would have taken in Royal Avenue frontage, as well as land to the back, including Smithfield Market.
From the 1940s, the site was reimagined in several different ways because, at least from an ownership perspective, development was viable. But its final outcome was never a foregone conclusion. Comprehensive redevelopment did not necessarily mean the construction of a large all-in-one mall within a single building.
By the 1980s, the city around Smithfield and Royal Avenue had changed in ways no one could have foreseen. And in the context of a city recovering from conflict, the area had taken on new significance.
So there were already some private developers in the background in the early 1980s, some of which would have been essentially a consortia of existing local traders in the area that were proposing a more modest reuse of existing buildings for the site. At the time, that wasn't seen to be viable, and it wasn't going to have essentially the institutional backing of the state.
Those plans weren't viable, partly because there weren't mechanisms yet for government to support smaller-scale private investment. But also, by then, there was a new political fervour for large-scale development. Belfast needed to make a statement. The conflict had stagnated the city's economy, and investors needed to be reassured and enticed back in.
Redevelopment on a large scale was seen as politically necessary to showcase Belfast, to project confidence and defiance. Small incremental improvements would not make national or international headlines.
Various connections had been made, and some England-based developers were interested in maybe taking something forward. John Lang Developments and Ellison Hart, they were slowly coming on board in the background, talking with the government agencies in relation to a possible development scheme. And it really all sort of started like that. It was like a stone gathering moss, essentially, and gathering momentum.
Back then, local councils had no planning or regeneration powers. Under direct rule from 1972 to 1998, strategic decisions for Belfast were being made by the government in London.
In the late 70s, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland under the Labour government was Roy Mason. He is credited with a new focus on public-private partnerships to regenerate the city centre, captured in his 9-point plan for the rebirth of the city. This plan established two key elements that would determine the final form of Castlecourt.
In the decade prior to that, it was really about defensiveness in Belfast in terms of government policy, so creating the Ring of Steel, doing various other things. But then there was a slow movement in the late 70s and 80s towards doing something more positive, creating development potential, trying to bring people back into the city centre, establishing entertainment venues. So this would have been a site continuing on from the urban area plan, potentially earmarked for that kind of public-private development.
So that was the first element of the strategy, development that would bring people back into the city centre for recreation. The second element was the decision to move government offices out of the Stormont estate in the eastern suburbs.
That was again part of emerging government policies from the late 1970s. Instead of having public sector workers working in offices at the Stormont estate or in peripheral zones, that because of this idea of a neutral city centre, they wanted to then bring these offices into the city centres. So, you know, a significant amount of this development is really office space.
And so by the 1980s, all the pieces have fallen into place. The political momentum has been established and is taken up by the Conservatives when they come to power in 1979. The ownership of the land is consolidated in public hands.
A strategic plan for the city defines what the development should accommodate. Investors are connected with the scheme, and their proposal has the government backing it needs to progress. With the principles defined, it's time for the form to take shape.
Early in February 1984, an advertisement appeared in the local Belfast press. The ad announced that outline planning permission was being sought for a new development on the Smithfield Royal Avenue site.
What that outline presented would be almost unrecognisable to anyone who knows Castlecourt today. It was, by comparison, modest in scale and turned around so that the large anchor retailers would have been located at what is now the rear of the mall.
The scheme was contained within one city block, with Berry Street on one side and Garfield Street on the other. At this smaller scale, the scheme didn't need obtrusive service yards, and it maintained the historic permeable street layout.
Whenever the first permutations were being developed and the drawings were being created, the initial proposals by the developers, they were smaller than what we have now. For example, this wall wasn't there, and Garfield Street, that also wasn't built over.
The same day as the planning application appeared in 1984, in the same press, a letter was published from Chris Patten. Patten was then the direct rule minister in charge of the DOE, the government department that would ultimately evaluate the merits of the application. His letter was unrestrained in its celebration of the proposed development and its potential to breathe new life into the city centre.
Chris Patten, a key government minister during the Thatcher era, and he was very interested then in stimulating some kind of development within the city, and especially using property-led developments, using marketing and various other things to try to stimulate private sector investment, but very much stimulated by public intervention as well. He was a key minister even before Richard Needham came on board as the government minister, who's perhaps most associated with Castlecourt, but Chris Patten was there, you know, meeting with the developers, ensuring within the Department of the Environment that it was generally on board with the scheme as it was emerging. And so he even met with the developers the week before they submitted their outline planning application. And then on the day that the planning application was submitted, there were positive articles within local newspapers about this scheme. You know, if the minister has made such a positive pronouncement on this particular development, well, what kind of pressure does that create for the actual planners when there's such high-level ministerial support?
The planning application, however, was far from universally welcomed. Just a month earlier, the Ulster Architectural Heritage Society, a campaigning body set up to protect historic buildings, had made an announcement of their own in the press. The UAHS declared they would be seeking conservation status for the General Post Office on Royal Avenue. They had long sought to protect the GPO, and now that its functions had been moved to other locations in the city, they wanted to see it occupied with new use.
The appearance of the planning application blindsided the UAHS, as did the speed with which it was approved by the DOE. Within 2 months of application, the scheme had gotten the go-ahead. Even with the potential demolition of the General Post Office now looming daily, the UAHS kept up the fight.
So they had a conference in, I think, end of 1984 called No Mean City. And there would have been support from conservationists across the water. Significant names in the conservationist planning world were speaking at it, like Lord Brett Lionel Escher, who was a well-known figure in both conservation and modernist architecture. So he would have been there, Roy Worskett, who has written books on conservation back then.
These high-profile figures ensured good media coverage for the campaigners. The conference speakers did not hold back in their condemnation of the Royal Avenue Smithfield scheme. They were also critical of the DOE's lax record of building conservation in general. They referred to the proposed demolition of the post office as an appalling scandal. One of the speakers at the conference, Roy Worskett, drove home what was at stake.
Really, it seems inconceivable to me that that building should ever go. I can't imagine now, in virtually any English city or virtually any other European city, that that building would be allowed to be demolished. If this conference finishes today without making a stand on that one particular building and to see how it could be incorporated into any new development, and no doubt the area does need development, then I think we'll be wasting our time.
They weren't opposed to development per se. They just wanted certain buildings to be integrated within a potential development. That was the kind of thing that was already happening in Glasgow or already happening in other cities that politicians might look towards in relation to regeneration. And they used their capacity to generate media attention, to bring on board popularisers, including from across the water, which was, I guess, significant in the context of direct rule. Because, of course, with government ministers that were not elected here and that were essentially coming from England and Scotland, that capacity to worry politicians because of losing votes wasn't there. So opposition from across the water was important.
Meanwhile, negotiations were ongoing between the DOE and Lang Developments about what the final scheme should contain and how it should look.
Initially, the proposal would have been for a postmodernist sort of brick facade, which was then heavily criticised, including by the government minister. And that's when it changed to what we have now in terms of a glazed facade.
The choice of a glass facade was not just aesthetic. It was also a gesture of audacity in a city internationally associated with bombings. Here was an opportunity to make a bold statement right on one of Belfast's main avenues.
Whereas, of course, the large brick, monolithic brick facades to the rear leading towards the multi-storey car park transmit a very different signal to the front. But the front was seen as a prestige, which is partly why they also then moved the anchor tenant to the front.
Over time, the retail components came to dominate the project, requiring the mall be expanded in size. On the southern end, a new service yard was required that would cut across Berry Street, essentially dividing that thoroughfare in half. On the northern end, a bigger allocation of space to an anchor department store meant encroaching further into the old Smithfield Market and building over Garfield Street entirely.
So then you can see that change then over the subsequent years where the scheme essentially got bigger, and that's when some of these other permeability, lack of permeability aspects came into the development process. But I think for me it's a kind of a strong irony that the initial proposals did not have, you know, some of these problematic aspects in relation to permeability and in relation to building over historic streets such as Garfield Street.
The DOE enabled this expansion through the use of compulsory acquisition, purchasing any remaining privately owned land around Smithfield. Included in that compulsory purchase was Samuel Street, one of the last remaining residential terraces in the city centre. This street still had people living on it who opposed the demolition of their homes, to no avail. Meanwhile, part of the development would also entail the construction of a replacement for the old Smithfield Market, behind Castle Court.
And I'm not actually sure then, in terms of the new Smithfield, that it certainly has been described as not having had the same soul as the old one. But of course, that may just be the passing of time being required, because of course the old Smithfield was old, and higgledy-piggledy buildings and various other things like this. That would have given it a certain character and patina of age, that developed over a longer period of time.
You might recall at the beginning of the episode, we talked about how Royal Avenue is a planned development that itself erased much of the existing streetscape. It followed the line, more or less, of the much narrower Hercules Street. In the late 19th century, much of Hercules Street was still residential.
The terraces of Hercules Street were broken up by narrow entries leading from the main street into self-contained courtyards. Houses lay within these courtyards, and though large, were built in an unassuming vernacular style, many of them dating back to the 18th century.
When Royal Avenue cut a swathe through the city centre, all but one of these vernacular residences were lost. Torrens Market survived, tucked away in a little courtyard off Garfield Street. One writer foreseeing in the 1960s the redevelopment of the area surrounding Torrens Market implored, "Now that the town planners are remodelling our grand old town, let us hope that when the time comes for a decision to be made on our older buildings, this lovely old house with its apple tree and its rambling rose will be left in peace." Torrens Market was demolished to make way for Castle Court in 1987.
Despite vociferous opposition from several quarters, Castle Court went ahead.
The conservation movement, which was the primary and most outspoken source of opposition, was still finding its voice at the time. Though they weren't able to save the General Post Office or prevent the wider destruction of built heritage in the wake of the Castle Court approval, Andrew can see traces of that campaign running through various city developments since.
Certainly some aspects of conservation were bolstered because of the opposition to the likes of the Castle Court development. So even though there has been a lot of good conservation work undertaken in the city since that time, and bearing in mind the first conservation area was only designated in 1987 in the Queen's area, it's very familiar. It's certainly set a marginalisation of conservation.
Some things have changed. Conservation itself has become more expansive. At the time of Castle Court, for example, conservationists placed little value on vernacular and working class architectural styles, such as Torrens Market and the residential terraces at Samuel Street.
No one particularly suggested that the Royal Avenue buildings individually were first class buildings, but it was the coherence of the streetscape that was particularly important. It would have been quite an ambivalence to some of the red brick buildings, so the residents that were still here were living in the typical Belfast two up, two down, as well as then that vernacular farmhouse. There would still have been an ambivalence amongst conservationists in terms of their attitudes towards those types of buildings. Now, looking back, I think they would also be protectable, let's say. They would be listable in the context now if they were still there, in particular that farmhouse at Torrens Market. I think it probably would be some of the top listing grades if it was still there because of its age and rarity value. Its demolition more or less passed unnoticed in many ways.
The governance context in Northern Ireland has changed too. For example, the power to make planning decisions for Belfast has been returned to the City Council. Some things, however, have sadly stayed the same.
I think there are still significant echoes throughout all of these big developments in Belfast. I think it's really hard for people to oppose developments. The history of Belfast is a history of big developments. You know, one big development and the hyperbole and the Boosterists, which certainly would have all been around Castlecourt and would have been all around subsequent developments. And the access, the people in positions of power that they have to media to disseminate those kind of messages, whilst there was a certain core civil society, there's still not a perhaps necessarily coherent, large-scale civil society movement. So other interests tended to win out, particularly where large developments were concerned. And as I said, there's always a shadow world, and it's really difficult very often to know what's actually going on. And I certainly found that in trying to piece together the archival traces. To a large extent, the people that were opposing these developments were necessarily reactionary, because they could only react to something once it was in the public domain. But of course, lots of things were always happening, you know, in the background that they would not have known about.
The development of Castlecourt was made to appear logical, even inevitable. But as we have seen, work went on for decades behind the scenes to allow it to happen, from land assembly to urban development grants through several design permutations.
The scheme would not have been viable without enormous investment from the DOE. They provided more than £15 million of public money to entice the developers to invest, including £10 million in the form of an urban development grant. They covered the costs of extensive infrastructural improvements and pre-let office space within Castlecourt.
None of this is unheard of in urban regeneration. Belfast was a high-risk investment at the time, so inducement was necessary. Though planning permission was granted in a period of relative calm, this was disrupted in 1985 with the signing of the Anglo-Irish Agreement and a renewal of paramilitary activity in response. The conflict impacted directly on Castlecourt.
It might have been couched as, you know, we're building a glass facade in a city which is known for bombs or car bombs. But in the background, of course, they were taking all of those kind of precautions in relation to potential bombs, bomb damage. Essentially, there are blast walls behind the glass. And there were obviously bombs in the context of its development. Several bombs, including one which destroyed the original architect's model of the scheme. And again, that played into a certain narrative that the government was trying to promote, that this is creating jobs, whereas all of these kind of attacks are destroying jobs, essentially.
So easing the way for private developers to invest in the city made sense in this context. Where things get murky, however, is that the DOE failed to build in what are called clawback arrangements. These are provisions whereby any profit made on the development would be shared between public and private investors. Castlecourt was sold in 1994, only 5 years after it opened. The developers made £16 million in profit, none of which found its way back into the public purse.
They made just over £16 million. And there was no clawback to the public purse, partly because the clawback period had been reduced from 5 to 2 years. And so that was a significant criticism of the DOE in relation to the significant subsidies that were going from the public, but then no clawback from the profit. And they also criticised the note-taking, the lack of notation around decisions and why that period was reduced from 5 to 2, etc., etc. I guess it left a bad taste for those that weren't necessarily conservationists, but those that would have been opposing this type of development just because of the privatisation of space and how it was sold as a significant private investment when the actuality was a lot more complex. Essentially the risk was socialised, the profit was privatised, and that moral hazard aspect didn't figure really in the discussions at the time. Of course, when you're trying to do archival work, if there are no notes taken, no minutes, it's not archived. So even 40 years from a decision, there's no way of telling except with interviewing the person and them talking about it. And so it does significantly alter potentially our historical understanding of how things happened. I think we don't pay very much attention to governance and institutions, and because it's dry and perhaps boring, but it is of course critical to how decisions get made. And I think we probably need to pay more attention to those things.
Almost 30 years on from its opening, the consumer tastes and expectations that Castlecourt's design responded to are no longer the same. Shoppers again prefer the variety and atmosphere of city streets, and retailers are following them to smaller, street-fronted units. The big department stores that often provide the commercial anchor to big centres like Castle Court are struggling for survival.
Castle Court now feels very of its time, and as the city shifts and morphs around it, its scale and form make it hard to respond. Its impact on surrounding areas too can still be felt.
Lots of these areas were kind of left after the Castle Court development that it didn't address, and it's only now that we're seeing certain things are probably being put right in terms of public space and trying to think about those issues of permeability, making these more lived spaces and not the dead zone that was essentially created external to that covered shopping mall development.
What will become of Castle Court in the future is still unknown. It has changed ownership several times since it opened, as have the areas surrounding it. Cities never stay still.
It's obviously interesting that these processes and plans are still emerging, because in a sense it's all almost implicit criticisms of everything that went before, including the likes of the Castle Court development. What was perhaps seen as a silver bullet, you know, wasn't. And so even that whole rhetoric about this is regenerating, etc., is obviously shown in the fullness of time to not be the case.
The Infinite City is a production of Place, Northern Ireland's built environment centre. Make sure you subscribe in your podcast app or on iTunes so you can get future episodes as soon as they're released.
If you like what you hear, you can rate us and leave a review on iTunes, which really helps us to reach more people. You can also support the podcast by donating. The link is at placeni.org/theinfinitecity, where you'll also find show notes and some additional content.
Tell us what you think via Twitter at Infinite City Pod and on Instagram as The Infinite City.
The Infinite City is produced by Rebecca McCabe and Connor McCafferty for Place, with graphic design by Maria Postanagova and script support from Stuart Gray and Kelsey Hansen. It's supported by Fielding Clegg Bradley Studios and Arts and Business Northern Ireland.
We'll be back in August for the final episode of Season 1.